Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Saturday or Sunday, wherever you may be in the United States of America or around the globe, this is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. And we're going to welcome several more AM affiliates here in the next week or two, but more on that when those shows come up. We have a boatload of stuff to cover. We always do. And, you know, I'm going to steer away from, except for the rat-a-tat-tat, which will be current events that'll make your hair curl. I'm going to steer away from a lot of the news and poo-poo and caca you've been hearing over the last week. I want to operate on the stratosphere here, this much bigger picture that we're going to be talking about today. I'm going to finish up the historical story on the Supreme Court. We've had three segments on that over the last 3 weeks, and we're going to finish up very briefly. Only three cases left to go. I think we've covered 45 or 50. If you have not listened to them, please do. This is important stuff. These cases shape your life today, shape your future, unless overturned, reversed, or modified. And they will play an absolutely critical role in a number of bombshell cases on their way to the Supreme Court. Mandates, vaccine passports, military forced vaccinations, Roe versus Wade. There's some huge cases that are winding their way up through the judicial system to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will decide it based on these precedences and based on the wording of the Constitution. That is, if the conservative justices remain originalists, you know, not interpretive jurors, as progressive and liberal judges seem to be. And then we're going to start what is probably going to be a three, maybe even a four-part historical story on education. And today we're going to cover really education back to 2000 BC. It is important that you have the foundation. What is education? How did it start? How did it evolve? We're going to be talking about the logistics, the mechanics of education, all the way up to, give or take, 1850 America today. And then next week, we're going to kind of round out the logistics and the history, the mechanics of education. And then in the last week, we're going to talk about what education has morphed into. It is no longer, as we know, the education of humans to advance. It is not reading, writing, and arithmetic. It has a whole deeper and much more sinister purpose. It is, you might call it, the propaganda brainwashing of the young to achieve a long-term result. And that result will not resemble the America you've known in the past or the America you know today, unless we get involved. We're going to talk about some slips of the tongue by the global elite, you know, the World Economic Forum. I just barely got into that last week. And then we're going to go right into that question I asked you at the end of the last show. If you had lived in Concord or Lexington back in 1776, April 19th, 1776 to be exact, and you had heard the call to arms echoing through the night and the early morning by Steve Dawes since Paul Revere had been captured, would you have mustered? Would you have stood in the dew of that early colonial morning with your villagers side by side, those that had mustered with you, scared to death, trembling hands holding your musket, looking from one to the other. What is Harry going to do? What is George going to do? As the drums and fifes and flags unfurled across the green or on the other side of the Concord Bridge. And the British Army, the most powerful army in the world, advanced toward you in perfect marching order and rows, bayonets leveled. Would you have mustered, and would you have stood your ground? That was the question that I left you with last week. We're going to talk more about that in this show, because the time is coming. I have some interesting things to share with you today. One article in particular. And we're going to go through a list of absolutely horrendous, upside down, topsy turvy, 2 + 2 = 5 nonsense going on. And it's all intentional. None of it is incompetent by the democratic Marxists and the globalists in lockstep with international enemies of America, particularly China, secondarily Russia, and in a tertiary sense, Iran and radical Islam. But that is the question of our time, folks. Would you have mustered? Would you have stood? We are all going to have that choice in the coming months and the coming years. And the future of America and the future, perhaps, of the world will depend upon our decision. Absolutely, the future of our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren will depend on our decisions. It will also depend on what we do aside from that, particularly in the coming months leading up to 2022. We're going to talk a little bit about that today, too, because really, the battle will rage on two fronts, as we will discuss. Then we're going to talk a little bit about there's an avalanche, there's a cascade of new research coming up on these vaccines. Japanese research, Israeli research, university research from several universities who are not playing politics. They're just into science, not the claptrap that we hear from the media and the government, which has really grown to the point where if their lips move, if they exhale, it is a lie. And we're going to go into some of that in the last part of this show, which will be the rat-a-tat-tat. And boy, do I have some rat-a-tat-tat emphasis on the rat for you today. So let's get started. Oh, by the way, we're going to go over some recent court cases, too. It's almost kind of blend in with the rat-a-tat-tat. All of them but one have gone our way, and all of them are key, and all of them are headed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will decide, based on the Constitution and based on the precedents of the Supreme Court cases going back to 1803, which we've discussed now for the last 3 weeks, and I think are fascinating, the future of this country and the future of the world. It's that big a deal. Let's start off with our historical story, Supreme Court, Part 4. We are now into 2009 and 2008. We've come all the way from 1803. And this is a case, and you've heard of it, called Citizens United. Let me give you the background of this case. This is a huge case. It plays into our election system, the election fraud of 2018, possibly of 2012, i.e. Barack Obama, and certainly of 2020. And it continues to play out in elections around the land, including, by the way, the failed recall of Newsom, Gruesom Newsom, out there in California. So there was this nonprofit organization called Citizens United, and they made a disparaging film about Hillary Clinton. Oh, gee, how could you possibly disparage Hillary Clinton? And they wanted to advertise so that people would go see the film before the 2008 election. But at that time, the Federal Election Campaign Act banned corporations and unions from spending money to advocate for any party or any theme or any idea or any candidate during elections. So Citizens United couldn't advertise, and they couldn't even show the film. since it mentioned Clinton, who was a presidential candidate at the time. You know, her second or third run? Whatever. Citizens United sued. They argued that the ban was unconstitutional. It wound its way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held 5-4 that corporations and unions can spend as much as they would like to convince people to vote for or against political candidates or agendas, as long as the spending is independent of the candidates. This is a really big deal. Independent of the candidates. Now, with the corrupt system that we have going right now, expect this whole decision to be revisited in some way, shape, or form. And one of the things that we need to do to get elections back on track, folks, is to revisit this decision. We'll talk about that a lot more in the coming months, because until you get a handle on the money in elections, you can't get a handle on the corruption in elections. It's really that simple. Anyway, the ruling gave corporations protections under the First Amendment's right to free speech. John Paul Stevens, one of the justices, wrote the dissent, quote, "It is a rejection of the common sense of the American people and a threat to democracy." You know, in retrospect, John Paul Stevens was correct. This decision changed how politics works in the United States. Remember now, this decision's only like 12 years old, give or take. In the 2014 Senate elections, outside spending doubled to $486 million, twice what it was in 2010 prior to this case. And it's gone berserk from there. Now we're in the billions. And doesn't count, I might add, as an interjection, that doesn't count the corrupt, illegal spending by private parties. You know, like $450 million by Zuckerberg of FB to pay campaign workers and buy drop boxes in certain areas and et cetera, et cetera. Then we have the National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius, 2012, another big case. This was around Obamacare, and she was the Secretary of Health and Human Services. You might remember, she was nothing impressive, should we say. Barry Obama, our buddy Barack, the enemy of the United States, signed the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, into law in 2010. We could get into the corruption that went into the passage of that act. Do you remember the election of Brown in Massachusetts and the midnight vote the day before he was going to take office so that the Democrats could pass it by one vote? But we won't. We're going to stick with the Supreme Court here. So 26 states, a number of people, and the National Federation of Independent Businesses sued immediately to overturn Obamacare. The first issue was whether it was legal to require people to purchase health insurance with an individual mandate. In other words, if you didn't buy it, you got fined. You know, the $2,000 or whatever fine it was. The second was whether a provision that forced states to cover more people or lose federal funding, you know, the sword of money, was unconstitutional and coercive. Once again, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court held the individual mandate was legitimate because it was, in essence, a tax. Do you remember our buddy John Roberts, who switched his vote at the last minute? I've always wondered what they had on him. And that struck down a provision that would withhold funds for states, which did not expand the program. In other words, it was a bifurcated ruling. They said you can't punish states with funding, but you can nail American individuals, with $2,000 and call it a tax, even though the act says it's not a tax. And that's how they kept Obamacare alive. It's just that simple. Dissent was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, and his dissent, and I quote, "This decision is a vast judicial overreaching, which will create a debilitated, inoperable version of healthcare regulation," unquote. And you know what? Justice Kennedy was correct. And to go one step further, it was intentional. Barry Obama and the Democratic Marxists, who at that time had, they were still under cloak, you know, they were pretending they were moderates and pro-American, not like in your face like today. They planned for this system to fail. This system was designed to fail because in its failure would emerge, and this is the age-old Marxist theory, tear down what there is and then rebuild what you want. In its stead would emerge universal health care, which, by the way, you'll see rear its ugly head after 2022 if we don't take the midterms. Then we have another really kind of monumental case in a lot of respects. It was Obergefell, that's O-B-E-R-G-E-F-E-L-L, versus Hodges, 2015 case. Here's the case. Obergefell and John Arthur, a couple, two men, got married in, they were from Ohio, but they got married in Maryland. In Ohio, same-sex marriage was not allowed on death certificates. Arthur was chronically ill, and he wanted to have Obergefell on his death certificate, along with three couples in kind of a similar situation, Kentucky and Michigan and Tennessee. They sued their various states, claiming that the restrictions on these death certificates and the names that could be on them was a breach of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which, as an aside, says, I quote, "No state shall deny to any citizen within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws," unquote. Now, obviously, the Democratic Marxists, they only use that when they need it, because unequal application of the law is the norm of the day and has been since at least Barry Obama's second term, which, by the way, is not a coincidence. Anyway, the Supreme Court held 5-4, another 5-4 decision, that the 14th Amendment guarantees the right to marry, including same-sex marriages, and that every state in the U.S. had to abide by that. And that included death certificates, that included marriage certificates, basically equal rights for all. Every state in the United States now legally recognizes same-sex marriage. That was not the case at the time. That's just 2015, folks. That's 6 years ago. There were 13 states in 2015 that still banned gay marriage. This led to the whole LGBTQ movement and all its tangents. You know, the transgender and the, you know, gender neutral, and I can't even give you all the list. But this is the case that allowed all the stuff we see that we scratch our head over. You know, the military funding sex operation changes. Oh, General Milley, another good job. This is where it started. And it's not going away. It's going to get more and more raucous, more louder and more shrill, as you will see in the coming months and years. Let's talk about education. Let's start our historical story on education. It's really kind of fascinating. And what I really want to do today is just bring you up to speed on logistical history. And we're going to go back to the first known school. I mean, it's really amazing how this has evolved and what it's become today. But you'll see that the mess we have today started long, long, long ago. It started in earnest in terms of Marxist socialism in the 1920s here, a la Woodrow Wilson, a la Lenin, and his infiltration and subversion of the American school system, which we're going to talk about in the third segment of this historical series. But going back to 2000 BC, they have found cuneiform mathematics textbooks, and they know that education, formal schools, existed in China at this time period. Huh, China. And then you have the Age of Pericles. This is kind of the Greek time. Most Greek city-states had adopted a formal educational system. It's interesting. Sparta used its educational system to train their children for effective military support. Athens, Sparta's enemy, however, they stressed more intellectual and aesthetic lessons. If you know your history, you know who won the war between Athens and Sparta. We have the development of the Roman schools then. That was like 50 BC to 200 AD. And the Romans were very heavily influenced by the Greeks. Many Roman children, after they learned to read and write, attended school to study Latin, literature, history, math, music, and dialectics. And these, what was called Latin schools, are really, really, really similar to what is known as secondary schools in the 20th century. Then we have the Dark Ages, dark time on the globe. And that was basically 400 to the year 1000. Common people during this time were, you know, they were oppressed. They were serfs. They were politically and religiously stomped on. And it stunted the ability of the population as a whole to grow and to innovate, which had dire consequences for centuries. Certain people in the church, well-connected in the church, and of course in wealthy families, they were able to receive more complete educations and some small advances, but through that very limited class were made during this 600-year period of literally education and, in a whole bunch of other ways, darkness. Then we have the Age of Aquinas, 1225 to 1274. So Thomas Aquinas, I know you've heard the name. Most of the people during this time were taught by Catholic priests, many of whom were, like they are today, corrupt. And that's, by the way, not a sling and an arrow at you Catholics out there, you know. Every religion has its bad apples. Unfortunately, you've had kind of more than your share, and that's because it was suppressed by the Vatican until literally recently, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So anyway, Thomas Aquinas had a major effect on the educational system in the West and perhaps the world. He helped change the church's view, the overall view of the church, on how commoners should learn, grow, and acquire knowledge. Basically, he paved the way for the creation of medieval universities, institutes of higher learning which commoners could attend. Then we have the Renaissance, give or take the year 1350 through the year 1700. The Renaissance started in Italy, as you probably know. And it was a rebirth, really, that's why it's called the Renaissance, of people, all classes, all ilks, thirst for new knowledge. And the Renaissance kind of spread throughout Europe, and it led to a revival of learning called humanism. And you're going to see humanism evolve over the many, many centuries to what it is today, which is transhumanism. It's fascinating. And it's scary. But that is yet another tale coming up in the next week or two. Then we have the first, well, by now the colonies had been established. You know, the pilgrims had landed at Plymouth Rock. And education in the colonial period in America was usually private. It was done by parents. Or it might be religious, taught by priests. In the early 1600s, when Europeans began to form their colonies along the northeast coast of the United States, a lot of these people were fleeing religious persecution, usually because they were more religious than the powers in charge back home. So the education in those days was as much about Christian values as it was spelling and grammar and reading, writing, and arithmetic. You know, there was a differentiation, too, in the education that was offered and given between guys and gals back then. We're going to talk more about that because it's pretty interesting. In 1636, the very first university in the United States, at that time like a rundown building hole in the wall, called Harvard College, was established in Newtown, Massachusetts, and which was later renamed Cambridge, of course. And in 1642, you know, things started getting serious. The Massachusetts General Court passed the first education law, basically in North America and South America, as far as we know. It required parents to make sure that their kids could read and understand, I quote, the principles of religion and the laws of the Commonwealth. Boiled down, the state was beginning to dictate the purpose of education, at that time to make good Christians and well-behaved citizens. In 1779, You know, we're in the middle of the American Revolution. And future President Thomas Jefferson, this is the beginnings of the federal intervention in education. He proposed two different tracks in education, one for the laboring and one for the learned. Pretty interesting, right? Today we call it blue collar and elite. And this began what we have today, which is the class divisions that let already rich people get better educations and better job opportunities, generally speaking. A trend that continues to this day, although, let's face it, the vocational trades are rapidly catching up, at least in some respects and on many levels. Then 1801, believe it or not, there was a huge invention. It was called the blackboard. And this was invented by the names of James Pilans, P-I-L-L-A-N-S. And he invented the blackboard by hanging a big old slab of slate on a classroom wall and writing on it with chalk. It revolutionized education. In 1821, the very first government-owned, operated public school opened in Boston, Massachusetts. And it was named the Boston English High School. By the way, it still exists today. Let's regress about 200 years. The very first taxpayer-funded school was way back, also in Massachusetts, in 1639. You know, you have to wonder about Massachusetts, and I know I have a number of listeners back there, the lonely conservatives in the Bay State. Did they not teach common sense back there, guys and gals? I mean, did they just teach, you know, how to be elite? I mean, what's the deal back there? Because Massachusetts has elected Elizabeth Warren. Wow. And Massachusetts had as its governor Mitt Romney. Not as bad as Elizabeth Warren, but, you know, should we say not great. And Massachusetts is, 80 or 85% vaccinated or 90, whatever it is. And Massachusetts is still in partial lockdown. You know, it goes to prove that education is not everything. Then we go to 1821, actually 1823. There's a gal by the name of Catherine Beecher, B-E-E-C-H-E-R. By the way, her sister, little interesting historical sidelight, wrote the anti-slavery thriller Uncle Tom's Cabin. Pretty interesting. Do you understand that beginning back then is when you see the first advent of this racial division teaching? Just beginning to emerge. Anyway, Catherine founded what was known as the Hartford Female Seminary. It was basically, if not the first, one of the very first and very few that allowed ladies to get an education. I mean, this is a time when, you know, gals were supposed to, they were supposed to be learning how to cook, how to knit, how to do needlework, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and to run the household budget for milk and butter. But Beecher included traditionally male subjects in her curriculum, very first to do so, and it was really the first school to offer higher education to women. In 1837, the African Institute, which, by the way, still also exists under the name of Cheney, no, not Liz Cheney of Wyoming, Cheney, C-H-E-Y-N-E-Y, University, was founded in Pennsylvania. Cheney remains the United States' oldest institute of higher learning for African Americans. And also in 1837, Mount Holyoke Female Seminary opened as the very first college for women in the United States. Up to this point, this is a big marker. Higher education, college education, was reserved for white men. So 1837 was kind of a big year. And then 1851, this is when the state began to intrude in education. Not just from afar, but intrude on what was taught. intrude on the motive behind education. There was a Massachusetts Teacher magazine or newspaper, and there was an article in 1851, and I quote, "The children must be gathered up and forced into school," unquote. Yeah. By the way, in 1852, Benjamin Franklin established his school. And a lot of these schools, these original schools, were based on the principles and the teachings of a guy by the name of John Locke, basically 1632 to 1704. He was an Enlightenment philosopher. You know, this whole theme of humanism, which has now morphed into woke transhumanism. He wrote an essay in 1678. It was called Concerning Human Understanding. And basically his view was, when we're born, our minds are a blank slate. I mean, we are clean. We are unsullied with any knowledge or any learning. And that we gain knowledge through experience. It's his views of the mind and how people learn that were probably the single heaviest influence in the evolution of the United States educational system. We're going to leave it at there. We're going to pick up next week. We're going to finish up from 1867 to the current time. The history of things, the evolution, the logistical and mechanical evolution of education. And then the week after, we're going to go into what education has morphed into, using the mechanics that have evolved, including particularly in today's current age, technology. And we're going to talk about how to reverse the trend, which has been building like a tsunami of anti-American, anti-capitalist, anti-freedom, and anti-self-reliant individuality in our educational system for a long, long time, but particularly since the 1920s. Now let's talk about some current court cases. You might have heard of some of these. You probably haven't heard of most, and you certainly haven't heard of any details because, you know, why don't we just say the mainstream media, you know, they're not really into educating you or keeping you up to speed or giving you the big picture. Quite the contrary, they want to distract you with the glittering object of the day. All of these cases that I'm going over with you are going to wind their way to the Supreme Court, and they're going to be decided by precedents and the Constitution, what we've been going over the last 3 weeks. And you can determine for yourself, based on what we've discussed, based on history, how these rulings are going to go. So on September 14th, the Supreme Court Justice Lawrence Love, a Democrat of the New York Supreme Court, blocked a requirement by, you know, outgoing Andrew Cuomo, boy, what a peach, and loony Democratic Mayor de Blasio in New York. He blocked a requirement, or temporarily blocked a requirement, that all Department of Education employees had to get at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine by September 27th. I mean, that's coming right up, folks. On the very same day, another really good ruling, we'll see how they all come out in the end, but a U.S. District Court judge by the name of David Hurd issued a similar written order, and he blocked the statewide mandate requiring healthcare workers to receive vaccines by the last week of September. Basically, New York state officials who are trying to implement these mandatory vaccines had until September 22nd, just a few days ago, to respond to Hurd's, the U.S. District Court's order. And the hearings on this are coming up on the 28th for the state mandates, and were already held the 22nd, just days ago, on the New York City mandate. We don't have a ruling on that yet. It's unclear what impact these rulings, whatever they happen to be, are going to have on other states. But based on precedents we've talked about the last 3 weeks, whatever way that ruling comes down after these temporary restraining orders, these temporary blockages, will in some way, shape, or form affect what other states, particularly blue states, do in terms of vaccine mandates generally and for certain types of folks. healthcare workers, teachers, etc. So very, very interesting. Two big cases, and you know, in a state that you wouldn't expect those types of rulings. We'll see how they come out. However they come out, they will get to the Supreme Court. Then we have a federal judge. This was not a good ruling. This is the only not so good ruling for us in the last several weeks. But there's a federal judge in Washington who ordered, you'll love this, the government to stop using a public health law to deny families entry into the United States illegally. By the way, this district court judge, his name is Emmett Sullivan. Does that ring a bell? Oh, yeah. He was the loony judge in charge of the General Flynn case. You know, he was the judge who ignored the Supreme Court, ignored the appeals court, and decided he was going to, like, set up his own court and call in another judge to be kind of his advisor. Do you remember all that with the Flynn case? You know, poor Flynn, basically he's pardoned, and he couldn't get out of the case because of loony Emmett Sullivan. Well, this is the judge who just ruled that, you know, all those laws that were put into effect in March of 2020 in response to the pandemic to protect the American public from illegal aliens who have COVID, they just don't apply anymore. No, they just don't apply. They don't apply for illegal aliens, but I guarantee you the same judge would rule that mask and vaccine mandates apply to U.S. citizens. Yeah, you bet. Anyway, the effect of Sullivan's ruling is going to be dire. Families that are showing up at the border that would have been turned away legally because of COVID problems now will be processed and released, by the way, as they await their court hearings, which in some cases are 5 years out and which basically are voluntary show or no-show deals. This ruling came about, by the way, from a lawsuit that was filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. Boy, how far they have fallen, right? They filed the lawsuit in January. And you'll love this. The suit has been delayed. It's been on hold all the way since January, the spring, the summer, because of, oh, wait a minute, COVID problems. You know, the courts weren't open, etc. But it's okay if the illegal aliens come in. We're going to shut down the courts. You know, Emmett is going to shut down his court, but it's okay because of COVID, but it's okay if he lets illegal aliens in the country with COVID problems. You just got to kind of scratch your head. And at the same time, there were NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that were negotiating to relax the standards for thousands of families who are considered to be, quote-unquote, particularly vulnerable. So they cross into the U.S. at still closed border crossings at that time. You know, the Department of Homeland Security, by the way, when some reporters tried to question them on this, very few reporters because most don't care, they just didn't have a comment. Oh, okay. But their ICE enforcement division, their border enforcement division, had a comment. Quote, "The department lacks sufficient capacity to safely hold and process all individuals seeking to enter the United States during the global pandemic if the U.S. government restricts its ability to implement the CDC order." Remember, the March 2020 prohibition against certain types of illegal aliens who had COVID problems came from the CDC. Interesting. Anyway, now, by the way, while everybody is going to mask mandates and vaccine passports, and you lose your job if you don't get the jab, and the whole nine yards that's going on, you're familiar with it, the ACLU now has decided that the, quote, "policy was unnecessary to control COVID-19 in the U.S. and that the U.S. can safely allow migrants to seek protection," unquote. Wow. Okay. So, that kind of speaks for itself, don't you think? I think so. By the way, this was called Title 42, this ruling that Emmett Baby made. And you're probably going to see, maybe not definitely, but you're probably going to see this get to the Supreme Court also. because on one hand, they're going to be asked to rule on mandates, and on the other, they're going to be asked to rule on illegal aliens coming in without testing and without mandates and without vaccines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, rules for thee, but not for me. All right. Then we have a federal judge, good ruling for us, and his ruling just in the last few days orders Joe Biden to end his executive order, which ended deportation of illegal immigrants. You know, the decision came, by the way, to reverse Biden's executive order, you know, no more deportations, after Paxton, the Attorney General of Texas, sued on behalf of Texas taxpayers, obviously calling the order illegal. Texas sued over the policy, and the judge has issued a temporary restraining order. It's only good for 14 days, so once again, you know, this is not a complete ruling. We'll have to see how it turns out. Texas argued that the administration would be violating an agreement it has with the Department of Homeland Security, which, by the way, was that Homeland Security would give them 6 months' notice of any change in immigration law. Obviously, that has not been the case. And also that it was unconstitutional. The judge, his name is Drew Tipton. He's a Trump appointee. He's been on his bench for about a year, and he did rule that the deportation order, or the cease deportation order by Biden, was illegal, and that Biden had violated the agreement with Texas. We'll see how this all comes out. We'll see how it all comes out. Along these lines, I think we're going to be talking about in the rat-a-tat-tat if we have time. Biden's secretary violated treaties with the U.S. government and the Ute Native American tribe. You know, the same tribe, by the way, that is in my books, the Ute and the Sioux. And this was halting an energy project that directly benefits the Ute economy, and they argued violated Native rights lands. They won that suit. It's a great private property suit for our side, and a great ruling for our side on this attempted rollback of energy at all levels by President Cadaver, a la President Obama, third term. Another one, federal judge. There's a federal judge. You know this J6 commission, you know, January 6th commission that Nancy Pelosi cobbled together with rhinos like Liz Cheney and a bunch of rabid Democrats, including like Adam Schiff. Oh boy, what a winner. They didn't want to release to the defense for use in the hearings the video footage of January 6th. Gee, I wonder why. I wonder what that video footage would show. Well, we know what it's going to show, right? This is all set up. The government argued that, you know, releasing the footage would violate national security, would jeopardize our safety, because, you know, they're very concerned about that. Particularly, by the way, if you're an American captured by the Taliban in Afghan, they are really concerned with your safety. Yeah. And they're really concerned with your safety when they tell you don't use ivermectin and HCQ, but instead get the jab. Very concerned about our safety. Anyway, they now have to release all the Capitol video footage from January 6th to the quote-unquote defense team, if you will. It's going to be very interesting because that's going to be some footage that they've never released before. Ha! Huh. I wonder what that's going to show. In another case, this is kind of a lower court. It's a circuit court. This is in Missouri. Missouri has passed a Second Amendment Preservation Act. They're known as SAPA Acts, S-A-P-A Acts. And basically it says, we don't care what the federal government says about arms. It's called the Second Amendment Protection Act, by the way. We don't care what the federal government passes in the way of gun laws. We will not enforce them. We will only enforce whatever laws are on the books here in the state of Missouri. There's a number of states that have passed these. There's a number of states on the precipice of passing them, including Wyoming. That's a whole nother long, sordid tale. You even have rhinos. It's unbelievable. You have rhinos in the legislature of Wyoming. It's just, boy, they're pervasive. That's all I can tell you. But this is a big ruling. This ruling, folks, is, I almost guarantee you, going to get to the Supreme Court. Think about the Heller case that we talked about and some of the others. Then the Justice Department, you know, this is unbelievable. So I brought you the Heartbeat Act. I told you about that over the last several weeks that Texas passed. Basically, to make it really simple, you can't abort a baby after 6 weeks, you know, when you can hear the fetal heartbeat. And the left went crazy. They went nuts over this. And it went to the Texas Supreme Court. It was upheld. And then it went to the Supreme Court, who denied it cert. In other words, they said, we don't have to rule on this. It's constitutional. The law stands. You don't need a ruling from us. So the law stands. Basically, it stands based on the act, or should I say lack of acts, the intentional lack of acts, by the United States Supreme Court. It's a done deal, right? No. Not when you're dealing with democratic Marxists. It's never a done deal. Okay? The word compromise, I mean, every time I hear this word, I just puke. There's no compromise with these people. Working across the aisle, every time we work across the aisle, we get schnookered. It's just ridiculous. So the democratic Marxists weren't going to take no for an answer. So the Justice Department, because, you know, they don't have anything else that they ought to be watching, like, you know, cartels increasing their influence 1,000% along the border and 300%, including numbers of cartel gang members around the United States because of the open borders. We wouldn't want to focus on that. No. That's not important. And we wouldn't want to focus on, upholding the rights and freedoms of American citizens when it comes to mandates and that kind of stuff. No. We don't want to focus on that. No, instead, we want to focus on this Texas abortion law. So they brought a lawsuit, the Justice Department did, trying to overturn this law that the Supreme Court has already ruled on. I mean, you can't get any higher than that. Well, United States District Judge Robert Pittman, one-page decision just a few days ago, denied their request to block the law and said, you know, it is the law. You want to litigate it, but I ain't blocking it. That is a good thing. Good thing. Then we have another New York case, by the way. So there were 17 co-plaintiffs in this case, all medical professionals, and they argued that facing job losses, coercion, threats, trying to force them to take the COVID-19 vaccine, flew in the face of their religious beliefs. And that's another suit that kind of stemmed from the mandate that Cuomo made on his way out. We talked about several other rulings here just a few minutes ago. Well, in a really good ruling, there was a temporary restraining order also granted in that case by the same United States District Court Judge David Hurd. But it was limited to religious objections, well-founded religious objections. But nonetheless, it's a good ruling. It's a chink in the armor of mandates, which is always a good thing. His exact ruling, I'll give you one paragraph here, this will tell you, because he didn't mince any words. The DOH, that's the Department of Health of New York, is barred from taking any action, disciplinary or otherwise, against the licensure, certification, residency, admitting privileges, or other professional status or qualifications of any of the plaintiffs on account of their seeking or having obtained a religious exemption from mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. By the way, this was decided under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This also affected, by the way, teachers who were striking just a week ago against both the citywide vaccine mandate as well as Biden's national mandate. So this is a big ruling. Next case, the state of Arizona has now sued the cadaver administration over his announcement, a week ago, that mandates private companies with over 100 employees to require COVID-19 vaccinations. So we'll see how that deal goes down there in Arizona. Then a really interesting case. So there's an appeals judge in Ohio. He overruled a lower court judge. You remember I brought you that story last week about this poor gal who was trying to get a hospital to administer ivermectin to her husband, who had been sick since like July 6th, had been on a ventilator for 3 weeks, and was like 80%, he was at 20% lung capacity. I mean, basically, he was toast. Anyway, this appeals judge overruled the lower court, which had ordered the hospital to give this patient ivermectin. The court's ruling is really bizarre. While this court is sympathetic to the plaintiff and understands the idea of wanting to do anything to help her loved one, public policy should not and does not support allowing a physician to try any, in quotes, any type of treatment on human beings, unquote. This was done by Judge Michael Oster in the Common Pleas Court of Ohio. Obviously, Michael Oster is not familiar with the fact that ivermectin won a Nobel Prize in 2015 for treatment of humans. But, you know, I mean, minor point. Anyway, here's the good news in this story, because the ruling is not good news. But the good news is, and you gotta love this irony, right? They're not going to appeal this ruling, because Jeffrey Smith, the patient who was basically on the precipice of death, had received 13 days worth of ivermectin doses, and they were pretty heavy doses, when this appeals court made its ruling. Guess what? The hospital said they're taking him off the ventilator in the next day or two. Gee, I guess that ivermectin doesn't work, does it? Ha! Her attorney, by the way, a guy by the name of Larigo, he said, "Julie has won this case. I don't care what this judge says. We're believers he's going to survive because of the ivermectin." Pretty interesting. By the way, as a little background on ivermectin, because, you know, the press doesn't bring you this. Fauci lies to your face. The press lies to your face. The whole thing is absolute nonsense. You know, it's horseworm medicine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a guy by the name of Campbell. He was an expert in parasite biology. This is great background, and you should pass it on. And he was working in the United States. There was streptomyces cultures. It's called Amurostreptomyces. And he wanted to see if a component of one of those cultures could be efficient against parasites in domestic and farm animals. This is some time ago. Anyway, the agent that he eventually segregated from all this mass of jelly he was working with was called avermectin, A-V-E-R-M-E-C-T-I-N. It began to be used for livestock very successfully. Then they went one step further, and that was to try and isolate the chemical compounds to a more effective compound that could be used in humans. That is ivermectin. And ivermectin was tested in humans with parasitic infections. And basically, folks, it effectively killed parasite larvae. I mean, it killed, if there was a parasite, it killed it in the body or outside the body. Omura and Campbell's contributions basically led to a discovery of a new class of drugs. This is just a few years ago. And this is, by the way, if you want to check this out, go to NobelPrize.org. NobelPrize.org. You can read it for yourself. Don't have to take it from the cowboy here. I'm just a hayseed in Wyoming. Yeah. Anyway, I quote from the NobelPrize.org site, which obviously the judge in Ohio didn't read, and Fauci doesn't want to admit exists, along with Biden and the rest of them. Quote, "Today the avermectin derivative, ivermectin, is used in all parts of the world that are plagued by parasitic diseases. Ivermectin is highly effective against a range of parasites, has limited side effects, and is freely available across the globe. The importance of ivermectin for improving the health and well-being of millions of individuals with river blindness and lymphatic filariasis, primarily in the poorest regions of the world, is immeasurable. Treatment is so successful that these diseases are on the verge of eradication, which would be a major feat in the medical history of humankind." This is the drug, folks, that the CDC, the NIH, and Fauci says, oh, it's going to kill you. It doesn't work. This is the drug that the cadaver administration is trying to curtail use of in the United States. This is the drug that doctors are being threatened with all sorts of nastiness, including losing their licenses if they prescribe here in the United States. Never mind that Japan, by the way, just approved its use and is actually promoting its use countrywide. India did it some time ago, and several other countries have followed suit. I mean, you know, never mind that 3 billion people on the planet Earth are using ivermectin successfully, and that it won a Nobel Prize. We, you know, it's too dangerous for us Americans to use. In our next, should we say, little segment, I'm going to tell you about some slips of the tongue at the World Economic Forum. This is the creme de la creme of the elites. This is the nucleus of the globalist cabal. These are the folks behind the Great Reset. So there's a gal by the name of Christine Lagarde, real high up. You know, she's creme de la creme, elite of the elite. And she's talking with some of the other members, and the conversation got leaked. This is just, by the way, 2 weeks ago. I quote, "At the ECB, we have now wrapped up and concluded our strategy review, which was the first one in 17 years, and I was blessed to have an entire governing council unanimously agree that the fight against climate change should be one of the considerations that we take when we determine monetary policy. So at least the European Central Bank is of the view that the climate change is an important component in order to decide on monetary policy. Can we arrive at that trade-off between fighting climate change, preserving biodiversity, but securing enough growth to respond to the legitimate demands of the population? My first answer, Klaus," this is the head cheese globalist, Klaus, "is to be firm, is that to have a way of life, we need life." Listen to this carefully, folks. "And in the medium term, we do have major threats on the horizon that could cause the death of hundreds of thousands of people. So we have to think life first. We have to think way of life second." I want you to think about those words, folks. We have to think life first. We have to think way of life second. "How can we come," she continues, "how can we come together to make sure we secure the first priority, which is life, and also protect the way of life people have? And make sure that the cost of it is not so high for some people that they can't tolerate it. I think the trade-off that we reach will probably require," listen to this, folks, "some redistribution, because it is clear that most exposed people, the less privileged people, are those that are going to need some help." Let me boil this down to you. Your way of life and your freedoms are a distant second to the club of "you are going to lose your life if you don't do this." And by the way, if you don't do this and you lose your life, it's because you didn't redistribute your wealth to the poorer people so that they could have life, because they're less concerned with way of life. I hope that didn't come out too garbled. Let me boil it down succinctly. Your way of life's going to change planet Earth, not ours, of course, we're the elite. Your way of life is going to change because we're going to convince you that if it doesn't, you won't have life itself. And for us to save you from keeling over, from climate change, from COVID, from whatever else we dream up, we're going to have to take a big part of your wealth and we're going to have to redistribute it so that everybody is, you know, more or less equal in their cling to life and their loss of way of life. You guys get it? This is the Great Reset. She didn't use those words, but this is exactly what it is. Using pressure of all sorts, including, as she said, monetary policy. Which ties right into another rat-a-tat-tat we're going to go over, which is additional funding, $80 billion, to the IRS and the cadaver administration's wish that the IRS be able to examine any transaction in your checking account, I'm not making this up, in or out of $600 or more. I mean, they want to know exactly what you're doing with your money, folks, so that they can track it and they can take it when the time is appropriate. The CDC, it's been found out, along these lines, is building a database of U.S. households that have unvaccinated children. We're going to talk more about that next week, because this is all part of the same plan, folks. It's all part of the same deal. And now, before we get into the rat-a-tat-tat, I'm going to read you a couple parts from an article. Came out maybe, I think it was about a month ago, give or take. And I have quoted from it, a paragraph or two. But it came out in the Bob Livingston Letters. I've read similar things elsewhere, particularly over the last 60 to 90 days. They seem to be getting more prevalent. And this article was written by a guy by the name of Brandon Smith, who's a pretty good forecaster of things to come. And definitely a conservative. So this ties right in with what I just told you about Lagarde and Klaus at the European ECB and WEF and the Davos crowd. I quote from the article, "To understand the state of the world right now, it is important to accept the fact that there is a contingent of people in financial and political power that have a plan or a vision for the future. And part of their plan requires the removal of American patriots and conservatives, and the subjugation of the American people. It is our history of rebellion against tyranny that they need to erase, because it has the ability to inspire a future rebellion against the global totalitarian empire they plan to propose." And I'll read to you from it again. "People also need to accept another fact. Now that the globalists have openly set their agenda in motion with the pandemic lockdowns, forced vaccination plans, and medical passport schemes, they have a limited amount of time to achieve their objectives. Now that they have made their moves openly, a rebellion is brewing, and they are in a race to bring in their reset before patriots in the United States and other parts of the world stop them." I want you to think about these words. I want you to think about how all this ties in. These mandates, the J6 Commission, hiding the ball on that with the videos. The reason that the J6 Commission is happening at all is to make American patriots and conservatives look like domestic terrorists. Remember my historical stories. My historical stories on genocide. My historical stories on the collapse of civilizations. My historical stories on arms control and what always follows arms control throughout history. Back to Rome, when the government has the only weapons. History is a teacher. The guidepost of the future is the touchstone of the past, which is why it's under attack. I want to continue a little bit with this guy's article. I'm going to boil it down. We may go into more detail in future shows. There's other articles similar that we may also have. We may do a whole segment on it. But he believes that we're going to have a full-scale economic and social crash within the next 12 months. He thinks that this is going to be precipitated by the end of the eviction moratorium, which, by the way, is expiring this September. There are 12 million folks, 12 million renters that are behind on their payments. 26% of Americans are struggling to pay their bills overall, and I've brought you stories in the past, long before the pandemic, that 74% of the American population has less than $500 liquid that they could pull on or draw on at any given time. These are scary statistics. Scary statistics. Anyway, the other thing that's going to happen, and he talks about it also, but, people who own rental properties, who have been locked down, who haven't been able to get rent, who haven't been able to evict their tenants, you think they're going to hold on to these rental properties, folks, now that this is opening up? Or do you think they're going to get rid of their tenants and put the properties on the market? I mean, who wants to own a rental property you can't collect rent on, right? Still have all the expenses, still got to pay the mortgage, the taxes, the insurance, the water bill, you name it. But you don't get a dime from your tenants and you can't evict them. I mean, it's a massive private property takings. It is a redistribution. Gee, you remember what Lagarde said? It is a redistribution. And nobody wants to own a rental property if they think there's going to be another moratorium on eviction or rents by the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention. I mean, like, who gave them this power? Well, by us allowing them to do it, we gave it to them. We have to stop doing that. I mean, we have to stop doing that, like, right now. So he thinks there's going to be millions more Americans out on the streets, and the homeless population, and therefore the unhappy population, is going to explode. He also thinks that employment shortages, which of course we've been seeing, are going to be the downfall of small and medium-sized businesses. You can't conduct business if you don't have people to conduct the business with. And he talks about how this will knock out the small ma's and pa's, you know, the middle class, but it will enrich the major corporations who can pay more, the big box type deals. And then he sees the ending of the COVID stimulus checks and, you know, the goodies checks for unemployment, the extra money every week or every month. He sees the ending of that as creating consternation and chaos. And then he sees inflation as a huge match to the fuse, if you will. Because while all these other things are happening, the cost of living is going up. We've talked about inflation before. And then he thinks that, you know, the elite, because they're desperate to get this done quickly for the reasons I read you those two paragraphs, he thinks that the elite are going to try and institute more pandemic lockdowns. You know, and you're seeing it. You're seeing it in blue states. You're seeing it in Australia. You're seeing it in certain parts of Europe. And that's going to piss people off. And he thinks that people are wise to the fear-mongering now. I quote, "I think that lockdowns in blue states are possible again in the near term, perhaps over the Delta variant, but it may be early next year over some different type of variant. Most red states will remain open, and this will cause the Biden administration to go on the offensive against conservatives once again. I have no doubt that Biden will seek to cut off federal funds from states that refuse to comply with the lockdown agenda. The question is, will red states fold to this threat? And as some governors do, will citizens remove them from their positions?" Coincidentally, there was an article today that Biden is giving $150,000, you don't have to pay it back, grant to a county, or maybe it's a municipality, but anyway, a local jurisdiction in Florida who is not following DeSantis's order that you can't have any types of mandates, masks, vaccines, or otherwise. So you can already see what this guy is talking about happening. This is not a cutoff of funding. It's a reward of money. It's a bribe, if you will. A bribe. And then he thinks vaccine passports are on the way, and that's going to create a lot of angst. And he talks about the riots. Millions of people, folks, in the streets in Europe and many other countries, you know, that you don't hear about on the press. I've told you about them several times. He thinks that it might be a little different in the U.S. because we have a heavily armed population, but he doesn't think that's going to stop the globalists from making the attempt, because now they're committed. They're out of the closet, so to speak. And right now, he thinks that they're going to continue to use corporations and businesses as middlemen to implement these passport restrictions. I mean, you can see them doing it right now, right? We're not doing it. I mean, IBM did it. I mean, we're not doing it. Coca-Cola did it. We don't have any control over Coca-Cola. You know, all the nonsense. All the nonsense. He thinks that with passports, quote, "long-term tyranny is assured, and the elites will have micro-control over every aspect of our daily lives. Just as the communists in China have enacted a social credit system, we will have a similar system in the U.S. And all the government will have to do to end your life is to cancel your vaccine passport. Without it, you will not be able to participate in the normal economy, keep a job, or even go to the store." And then he talks about the building of alternative systems, economic systems, to the ones we have now by those who choose to stand against all this stuff. And he concludes with this thought, and I quote, "War is inevitable. When you are dealing with psychopaths, there is no reasoning. There is no logic. There is no diplomacy. There is no empathy. They want control over everything. They will do anything to get it. And the only option is to remove them by force as a threat. This is reality." So, it's one of the reasons I'm asking you these questions to ask yourselves. Would you have mustered? Would you have mustered at Concord and Lexington? And would you have stood? Anyway, we're going to go over a little bit more of this next week. But he thinks 2022 or 2023 is coming up quick, shall we say. Coming up quick. Once again, as is always the case, we're running out of time. So I'm going to get right into rat-a-tat-tat. We're never going to cover it all. But we'll cover as many as I can before we have to sign off. The CDC. This is on the NORC.org website. N-O-R-C-K website. Quote, "Once children are identified in the household," this is non-vaccinated children, "NORC works to obtain immunization records from the teen's health providers, and their ultimate goal is to vaccinate all children in the U.S. regardless of their financial status. NORC states it shares this data with the CDC, which then uses the reports in their own decisions to allocate resources for the vaccines. The CDC has announced nationwide green zones, a plan to isolate unvaccinated people in what are essentially heavily guarded COVID concentration camps that CDC claims will meet, I quote, "minimum humanitarian standards," unquote. So you can kind of connect all these dots, can't you? And then, of course, we have this government that cares so much for Americans. We send planes to Haiti, folks, on our dime, to pick up Haitians who then come to this country and who are released into this country, no COVID tests, no vaccines, no nothing, on the government dole. But we can't get planes to Afghanistan to get out Americans and our green card allies, interpreters, and people who work with us. Think about that. Then we have General Milley. Oh, God, he's back on the scene. He called the strike, this wonderful drone strike of Biden's, righteous. It's righteous. And, of course, all the media was, oh, how brave President Biden is. He's showing them. And then we find out, after 3 weeks, the Department of Defense in the last week admitted that the drone strike on the ISIS-K mastermind killed 10 innocent people. You've probably heard this, including 3 children. Basically, they hit this guy, the brother of a gentleman who is now asking for reparations, shall we say, killed his 3-year-old child because the kids were running out of the house to greet their dad when the missile struck. And he was a AIDS worker. He had nothing to do with ISIS. Zero. And you know, if this hadn't been uncovered, they would have let us continue to believe it. This smacks of Barry Obama and Susan Rice a la Benghazi. And since Barry Obama is the president, Susan Rice is the chief of staff for Gaddafi. Gee, I wonder. Then Glenn Beck, hats off to him. He's put a lot of money, time, effort, and heart into trying to get Americans out of there and Afghans out of there. He started with a rape list, 32 women that were on the Afghan rape and kill list. He was thwarted not by the Taliban, folks, but by our State Department, who wouldn't give the planes landing rights in the United States, or who claimed, after they had delayed them, that now the papers were expired. The State Department also blocked flights for these people, Americans and Afghans, to all countries. He thought he had a deal with Uzbekistan, and then it was blocked by the United States ambassador to Uzbekistan at the orders of Blinken, you know, the gag-me Secretary of State that we have under Gaddafi and Obama. I want you to think about that for a minute. Wow. Then we find out in the last week that this mandatory vaccine deal that Gaddafi put out, for all federal employees, guess who's exempt? Oh, yeah, Congress is exempt, folks. You know, just like they were the only folks in the United States exempt from Obamacare. Yeah. Okay, great. Then we find out that there was a leak at the highest echelons of Google that none of the big hotshot high-tech Google execs are taking the jab. No, you know what they're taking instead? They're taking HCQ and Z-Packs. You know, what's good for thee is not good for me. Yeah. And then we have the Secretary of Defense. Well, what a winner he is, Austin. Who along with Milley, is imposing this mandate on troops, including, by the way, Navy SEALs. And there's hundreds of Navy SEALs that don't want the jab, and they're not going to take it. You know what the response of the DOD is? Well, then we aren't going to deploy you. Gee, what's that going to do for national security, folks? There's been several commanding officers of SEALs. I mean, it interferes with a chain of command. It interferes with our operational capacities. It interferes with one of our most effective covert tools around the globe. And it absolutely weakens our national security. You know, coupled with our giving Bagram Air Force Base to the Chinese, basically, via the Taliban, and arming the Taliban instead of the people who you would think are our allies fighting the Taliban, it makes you wonder if this isn't all by design, doesn't it? Well, don't wonder anymore, because it is by design. It is by design. And then we have Mayorkas. What a winner he is, you know? Homeland Security Chief. I told you about him a year ago. He is a China-loving, China-owned, certified Marxist. And he lies through his teeth. He actually stood in front of cameras this last week and said, people shouldn't come here because we're not allowing them in. In the meantime, hundreds of planes are in the air distributing refugees, quote unquote, to all points and corners of this nation. I mean, absolute liar. And then Jen Psaki, Cadaver's press secretary, continues the lie. She goes, well, it doesn't matter. You know, the COVID testing and the COVID vaccinations for these people don't matter because they're not going to be here long. Oh, right. Yeah. You know, they and all their future generations will be here forever. Let's face it. And in the meantime, in Chicago last weekend, 64 people were shot, including 7 kids, including a 3-year-old that died. Do you hear a word about that? I mean, the COVID deaths are minuscule now. Minuscule. And 60 to 65% of all hospitalizations, all severe illnesses and deaths are in vaccinated people, not unvaccinated. You would think, since all this concern is being, you know, spouted and mouthed over COVID and mask mandates and vaccine mandates and, you know, do your community a favor and all this nonsense, that somebody would be looking at Chicago, because, you know, that's kind of a typical weekend in Chicago, even though it would set almost a new record. I think the record is 69 people shot in one weekend. Yeah, great. It's just terrific. Then we have inflation. This is probably going to be my last rat-a-tat-tat, unfortunately. We'll go over the rest next week. And, man, I got a bunch of them. So, as you know, we have inflation. Consumer goods have exploded. Gasoline is up, just in the last few months, 56%. Beef is up 2.3% just in the last month. Used car prices are up 30% over the last few months. I want you to think about that. Overall inflation right now is 5% a year, and that's how the government calculates it. If you want to find out what real inflation is, go to realstatistics.com. That'll give you the real story. It is way more than 5%, folks. And so that means that if you are earning, if you didn't get a 5% raise in your pay, you are now losing money over what you made in previous years. Losing money. This, by the way, was an article in the Wall Street Journal. Hardly a rag paper. There's a common theme to this rat-a-tat-tat, and that is your government is lying to you. If they move their lips, they're lying. It doesn't matter the subject. Immigration. The vaccines, COVID, Afghanistan, and they are lying to our allies. In case you don't know, our greatest ally, Britain, was completely cut off from communications with America at the height of the fall of Kabul and the chaotic evacuation. When Johnson, the prime minister, finally got on the phone with Biden, he pleaded with him to, quote, not throw away the gains made in Afghanistan. Obviously, that didn't happen. The British are calling Biden's withdrawal and lack of communication, quote, shameful, unquote. And then France, you probably heard, withdrew its ambassador. Once again, you know, you can lie by omission or by statement. Kadhafi's administration completely cut them out of the loop while they were negotiating a deal to sell nuclear submarine technology to Australia, who's worried about Chinese incursions into their waters. Well, the Australians had already made a deal with France to buy diesel submarines. So poor France, not knowing anything, loses a $66 billion contract with no chance to compete because, let's face it, this government, the United States government, lied to them by omission. And then, of course, we're told that the variants are going to kill us, and the vaccinated, the unvaccinated are the harbingers of, you know, future disease. Just the opposite is true. We're going to go into great detail next week. I'm going to bring you all sorts of studies from all around the world, all sorts of scientists, including folks who have worked for Pfizer and Gates and you name it. And just the opposite is true. Let me finish up with a little quote here. It'll kind of give you the biggest, repeated, always expanding and mutating like the virus itself, lies, packs of them, by your government to you. Let me give you Yeadon, Y-E-A-D-O-N, top scientist, work for Pfizer, you name it. This is what he says, quote, when your government scientists tell you that a variant that's 0.3% different, this is Delta, from SARS-CoV-2 could masquerade as a new virus and be a threat to your health, you should know, and I'm telling you, they're lying. If they're lying, and they are, why is the pharmaceutical industry making top-up booster vaccines? There's absolutely no possible justification for their manufacture, unquote. We are out of time, unfortunately. Next week, we're going to have our next segment on education, which you'll find fascinating, I guarantee you. And it's going to be the setup for this mess, this educational mess we are in right now, which is undermining and destabilizing this country as it was intended to do. We're going to go over a terrific article on several new studies that have come out in Japan, in Israel, by several universities. Let's see. The Washington University School of Medicine being one, which says, and I'll summarize, previous exposure and recovery from SARS-CoV-2 infection imparts lifelong immunity even when the infection is mild. Well, think about that, folks. So what is this vaccine mandate for people who have already been infected with COVID? I wonder. We're also going to be talking next week more about this Great Reset. And we're going to be talking more about this article by Brandon Smith I read you portions of, and several other people who are thinking like him. And in the meantime, I want you to ask yourself that question again. And I want you to ask another question of yourself. What is your red line? What is your red line? What is that line in the sand that has to be crossed before you muster? And you got to carry on the fight on the political front. We have to win the House in 2022. It might be a rear guard action because the real battle is for our kids. That's the future of the country. But that's in the educational segments coming up. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. You stay well. You think about those questions. And we'll talk next week on the Right Side Radio at Reagan.com. On the Right Side Radio at Reagan.com. If you wish to comment, please do. Thanks for listening.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.